You're listening to Asian Community Radio from Milton Keynes.
Good afternoon, everyone. You're tuned into Healthy Zindagi with me, Dr. Gayathri.
I
Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to Healthy Zindagi with me, Dr. Gayathri. Sorry about that. The song didn't fade out as I had intended to. But welcome back to today's episode. And I want to remind you all once again that the aim of this radio show is to raise awareness of different health and well-being topics. It is not a replacement for an appointment with your doctor. If you have any concerns at all about your health and well-being, I encourage you to make an appointment with your doctor so they can give you appropriate personalized healthcare advice. So with that, it's been a while since I've done a live episode, actually, and I did really miss it. I was away for the past few weekends, so we ran some older episodes that we had recorded, and I hope you enjoyed listening back. But we are back again today with a new episode of our Head to Toe series, and this is going to be my last episode of the Head to Toe series before I wrap up, and as I am moving for work, so next Sunday will be my last episode on Healthy Zindagi, and we'll have a kind of a goodbye session next Sunday. But anyway, keeping it today, we've got with us Mr. Thapuria, who is a consultant surgeon at Milton Keynes Hospital, and today we're in conversation with him with regards to all things with to do with the gallbladder and the pancreas. So these two are kind of different organs that can cause some issues in the body that can present and may require kind of urgent surgical assessment. So we will go through these different topics and break down what they really mean, what they are, what are some key red flag signs that you should be able to identify, and how and when you should seek help for this. And again, just to remind you all again, we'll break things down in a very accessible manner. As I always say, this radio station is for awareness. So it's not kind of giving detailed diagnoses or detailed management. It's about in making you aware of these different conditions and also these red flag signs. So before we move on to talking about kind of the gallbladder, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Thapuria to introduce himself as a consultant and talk a little bit about his background, his work, and his journey through medicine and what he does today.
Well, thank you, Gayathri. I'm Nitin Thapuria. I'm a consultant surgeon at Milton Keynes University Hospital. I've been there since 2018. I have a special interest in hepatobiliary, which is diseases of the liver, pancreas, gallbladder, which is why I have the honor of being here today and sharing this show with Gayathri. Prior to this, I have trained in hepatobiliary in some of the hospitals in London, Royal Free, Liverpool, and I've worked at Royal Liverpool as a consultant as well. I have quite a lot of interest in disease of the pancreas and liver and gallbladder.
Absolutely.
A lot of my practice is nowadays currently dealing with gallbladder disease, particularly complex gallbladder disease.
Absolutely. And what was it that made you want to go into surgery specifically?
So surgery was my passion when I was a child. I was inspired by my mother.
Oh, wow.
My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a surgeon.
Oh, wow.
And as destiny would have it.
Yeah.
I've also become a surgeon. My mother always used to compare me with him.
Oh, I see. Okay, I see. It didn't put you off, because that's what I've heard. So a lot of people say that, you know, with parents or grandparents being doctors or surgeons, they say, oh, actually, no, you know, we don't want our children or our grandchildren to be doctors, because they know what the life is like.
No, it didn't put me off. It only inspired me to be as good as I can be.
Absolutely.
And I kept working in that direction.
Yeah.
And then when I came to the UK, I used to tell my mother that now I've achieved something that her uncle hasn't achieved.
Absolutely. No, that's fantastic to hear. And thank you so much for coming on. It's really a privilege to have you on the show. So we'll move on to talk about the gallbladder first, in the first kind of hour of this show. And sometimes, you know, we know what the bladder is. Colloquially, we know this is like what holds urine. So I think people might be surprised to hear that we have another bladder, you know, in our body, which is the gallbladder. Can you just briefly describe, and how would you describe to your patients, you know, what is this gallbladder and why is it important? What role does it play in the digestive system?
So, you know, the liver sits in the abdomen on the right side, upper quadrant of the abdomen, and the liver is connected to the bowel by a tube called the bile duct. And so the bile goes down this bile duct, but before it gets into the bowel, it kind of diverts its flow into this organ called the gallbladder, which is connected to the bile duct by another tube. And the gallbladder essentially works as a reservoir. It stores bile. It helps to concentrate bile. And then it puts it back into the gut whenever we eat food.
Yeah.
And any kind of food would then stimulate the gallbladder to squeeze the bile out. And the bile will help in digestion of food. So that's the function of the gallbladder.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, the kind of common thing that people may be aware of is gallstones. So, you know, we know about kidney stones. That is something that, you know, that is well known within the Asian population, and with gallstones as well. How would you describe what are gallstones and how do they form?
So gallstones are stones in the gallbladder, as the name suggests. Mm. Now, these stones can be made of cholesterol, they could be made of pigment from red blood cells, or they could be mixed. The most common stones are mixed stones. How they form, there are lots of factors responsible. They're present in about 20% of adults, and 20% of those adults have symptoms. It's more common in the female gender.
Yes.
And it comes along with also with age, the prevalence increases. So as you grow older, 60 to 70 years of age is where incidence kind of peaks. It's more common in women because of certain hormonal influences as well. So if women are taking oral contraceptive pills, then the pills are associated with impairing the function of the gallbladder, slowing it down, and that can lead to stasis of bile. And then that acts as a bed for ultimately formation of stones. It is very common in women, again, in pregnancy, again, because of the same reasons. And the frequency kind of begins to increase after puberty, where it kind of peaks at stage when you are at parity. Then, of course, apart from age and sex, there are several other factors which come into play. So diabetes is an important risk factor. And then people who are obese or overweight, then there's a metabolic syndrome where obesity is associated with high glyceride levels.
Yes.
That leads to disruption of cholesterol metabolism, and there's increased cholesterol secretion in the gallbladder, in the bile. And then that acts as a nucleus for stone formation. Apart from that, physical inactivity. And then some people undergo rapid weight loss.
Yes.
Or small bowel operations or gastric bypass operations for weight loss. In these situations, there's disruption of the circulation between the bowel and the blood. It's called enterohepatic. And that therefore leads to disruption of solubility of cholesterol and bile. And that again leads to increased stone formation.
Yeah.
So essentially the two important things which lead to stone formation is a decreased motility of the gallbladder, decreased function, movement, and collection of bile, which is super saturated in cholesterol. And then there are other conditions as well, like blood disorders. So in these situations, there's a breakdown of red cells and they lead to more pigment in the bile. And that again, so it's common in people who have conditions like thalassemia or sickle cell, etc.
Yeah,
and then conditions like liver diseases, cirrhosis of the liver.
Yeah,
for the same reasons, supersaturation of bile.
Yeah,
and in sometimes people who take drugs which help to lower the lipid levels, like clofibrate, these drugs actually increase cholesterol secretion in the bile.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So if women, if a man or woman gains more than 5 kgs, they're at risk of stone formation.
Yeah.
And particularly in women, smoking and these drugs as well
can lead to that. I think what was interesting and reassuring is when you mentioned that in 20% of these people, these are symptomatic. So the vast majority of people will live absolutely normal lives with these stones in the gallbladder. Because sometimes, you know, when you find out, you know, you might have an ultrasound scan, or you might have, you know, we'll go on to different scans in a bit, but people might just become automatically concerned, thinking, oh, I have gallstones, I have to do something about this. But would you say that, you know, that the vast majority of people are completely asymptomatic with these gallstones, that the management of things will become largely lifestyle based?
So those who are asymptomatic, we definitely would advise them not to have an operation. And they can just wait and see.
Yeah.
About 2% of asymptomatic people will get symptoms in a year's time. And about 10% over the period of 5 years. Well, lifestyle, I mean, they've already formed stones. But yes, you would still want to try and reduce fat in your food. Because if you have more fat content, it can lead to something called biliary colic, which is pain due to gallbladder. And there are other factors as well. One must cut down on smoking, achieve weight loss, more exercise, just a healthy lifestyle.
Absolutely. We'll touch on this in a bit more detail. My next question was, you know, about biliary colic. So this is, you know, something that can be a very painful condition at times, and it can cause significant distress to patients because of this pain. How would you, so you mentioned, you know, biliary colic is pain in the abdomen that's related to, you know, the gallbladder and gallstones. How would you kind of explain this to patients as to what is causing this pain, and how can they, you know, and how is this all related to the gallstones as well, just to clarify?
So biliary colic is when you get pain in the right upper abdomen. Usually it comes on after a meal. Sometimes it's not related to food, but people get it all the time. And the pain goes to the back as well as to the shoulder. It usually happens because a stone is blocking the neck of the gallbladder and preventing the bile from draining out into the bile duct. So whenever you eat food, if the gallbladder is beginning to push the bile, it doesn't go out and the stone's blocking the outflow. So that's when you begin to get the pain. The pain then can get better if the stone drops off. So you, after a few hours, many people feel better because of the stone having dropped off.
Yeah. And in terms of the risk factors, so we spoke about the you know, common risk factors for gallstone formation. And specifically, we mentioned about how obesity, insulin resistance, different metabolic syndromes as well, high cholesterol, which are, you know, are quite common in the South Asian population, you know, specifically diabetes, you know, being very, very rampant, as well as, you know, linked with kind of obesity and hypercholesterolemia. How do you counsel patients that, particularly from a South Asian background, who are more susceptible for these conditions? And how would you counsel this in the in terms of the risk of gallbladder disease that comes with this?
Well, most of the time these patients come to us when they have symptoms. Once they have symptoms, then the then there's not a lot you can do, because obviously, ultimately, if their quality of life is impaired by symptoms, then they need an operation.
Yeah.
But for someone who may not want to have an operation or want to wait and see, sometimes people say they're pain-free. It'll all be about healthy lifestyle.
Yes.
So lots of exercise, eat and drink well, avoid fatty food, try and lose weight.
Yeah.
Particularly those who are obese or associated with the metabolic obesity syndrome, they will have to try and also make conscious effort to reduce their blood levels of triglycerides.
Yes.
Otherwise, triglycerides can result in disruption of the metabolism and lead to gallstone formation.
Yeah. And in terms of genetic links, is there a kind of a genetic predisposition that South Asians may have that increase the risk of gallstone formation directly? Or is it mainly through the kind of increase in the incidence of diabetes and obesity and hypercholesterolemia?
I think for South Asian population, it's associated with diabetes and obesity.
Yeah.
The genetic predisposition is more in the American and European population.
Interesting, yeah.
African Americans, Hispanics, and there is a genetic defect in transportation of cholesterol across the cells. So the cholesterol is not moved back into the liver cells and it stays in the bile, supersaturates the bile and again forms stones.
And forms the stones. Interesting. And in terms of diet, we mentioned, you know, that is a big part of the lifestyle management of gallstone and gallstone-related problems. Obviously, in an Indian diet or South Asian diet, you know, there is a lot of, you know, fat content and carb content as well. Are there any specific pieces of advice that you would give to your patients if they come to you asking for kind of this lifestyle and dietary related advice?
Well, essentially, they'll have to have a diet which is more rich in fiber, fruit and veg, like we say every day.
Yeah, five a day.
And cut down the
The sweets
and the carbohydrates. Yeah. I mean, only as much as you can. Obviously, you can have some healthy carbohydrates.
Yes.
Particularly the complex carbohydrates, which are which have got a slow release of carbs,
mm-hmm.
so things like oats,
yeah.
bananas and all, but
yeah.
you can't have lots of sugar and bread and other things,
because yeah, yeah.
those will be problematic. It's the sugar which then can gets converted to fat and causes problem.
Mm, absolutely. And I think I always touch back on this in every episode that we do. So I did an episode about many months ago now, last year in around November time, with Dr. Vijay Gupta, who's one of the consultants at Milton Keynes
mm-hmm.
In the acute medicine. And he is very interested in his lifestyle medicine. And we did an episode about lifestyle medicine. And in that, it was just so... I think it's an empowering episode because it teaches you that so many of these conditions can be prevented and well managed by eating well, moving more and keeping
yeah.
yourself healthy, avoiding things like smoking, drinking, and making sure that you have, you know, a good kind of family support network around you. So all of these things, you know, come back all together, and, you know, the gallbladder problems are not very different.
Mm.
I think it's nice to know that as patients, you can take control of your own health.
Yeah, interestingly, smoking is, of course, associated with gallstone formation, and more in women.
Yeah.
But interestingly, alcohol has got an inverse relationship.
Oh, interesting.
But of course, even then, if you drink alcohol too yeah. much in excess, it'll damage your liver.
Absolutely.
And cause fatty liver.
Yes.
So
it has its own bundle of problems.
Yes, so we might as well...
not to drink it.
Restrict ourselves there.
Absolutely. It's got issues when we link to the pancreas as well, which we'll talk about in the next segment.
And another important thing is physical activity.
Yes.
A lot of exercise is important to reduce the risk of gallstone formation. Exercise in some way is related to better gallbladder function. It's not been explained how.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just more physical activity, which kind of keeps your body in the right balance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in terms of kind of diagnosis, so moving on to the next section, in terms of common, firstly, moving kind of before we go on to the diagnosis, talking about the common signs or the symptoms that patients might experience. Well, you mentioned about the pain in the right upper side of the abdomen and sometimes even radiating to the shoulder tip as well. Are there any other kind of signs or symptoms that patients should keep an eye out for that should prompt them to seek urgent medical help?
So the typical symptom is the pain.
Mm.
Sometimes people tend to ignore bloating.
Mm.
You may get bloating after meals. You may have flatulent dyspepsia, as we say.
Mm.
So if there's flatulence along associated with abdominal pain, then one must think strongly about gallstones.
Mm.
Very rarely these stones can pass down the bile duct and cause blockage, and you might turn yellow or appear jaundiced.
Mm.
And also sometimes these stones can cause abdominal pain because of pancreatitis.
Mm.
So essentially, if you get these symptoms, particularly upper abdominal pain, then you must seek medical attention.
Mm, mm.
There are several reasons for upper abdominal pain.
Yeah.
But gallstones is one of the common ones.
Absolutely. And in terms of the diagnosis of biliary colic or even gallstones, for example, how is that pathway structured? How would that manifest in patients?
Well, usually patients would seek attention and they would have blood tests done.
Mm.
Blood tests may show normal liver function tests or may show an upset liver test, such as some enzymes may be deranged or the bilirubin levels may be up. That will prompt us to then go on to scanning.
Mm.
The most sensitive scan for gallstones is ultrasound. A CT scan is not that sensitive because it only picks up stones which have got calcium deposit and they're radio opaque.
Yeah.
But otherwise, most stones are radiolucent, and therefore, a CT scan will not pick them up, and ultrasound will pick them up. So the ultrasound is the gold standard for diagnosis of gallstones.
Absolutely. I think that it can be a common misconception. Everyone thinks that once you're in a CT scanner, it tells you all the secrets, you know. But actually, that's not true. In ultrasound, people might think, oh, this is a very basic test. Well, why do I need to do this? But like you said, this is the gold standard for the diagnosis. And we've spoken about kind of ultrasound and liver function tests as well in diagnosing gallstones. Once, you know, these gallstones have been diagnosed, like we've said, many a times they don't actually cause any problems. But in terms of, you know, the issues that they can cause, they can be linked with inflammation of the gallbladder as well, something like what we call cholecystitis. And when you have kind of emergencies like this, how would you say the standard treatment for symptomatic gallstones or biliary colic or even cholecystitis, for example, how does that all play out?
So if patients have symptoms and they've got pain and it's impairing their quality of life, or they've got inflammation, Then the gold standard is gallbladder removal.
Mm.
It's called cholecystectomy. It's done usually by keyhole.
Mm.
It used to be done by open technique many years ago, but now techniques have evolved.
Mm.
So the keyhole operation, laparoscopic cholecystectomy, is the gold standard. But again, it depends on whether the patient is fit enough to have this operation.
Yeah.
Some patients are not fit, and there are other options over there. So that just depends on the presentation.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key things that patients may not understand, may not recognize, is that after having this keyhole procedure, most of the time patients can go home the next day.
It's usually a day case operation.
Yeah.
They can go home either the same day if they come in the morning and have the operation in the morning hours. After a few hours of observation, if they're up and about, eating, able to pass urine, mobilize, they go home. Some people get unexpected pain or other problems because of the operation. They have to be kept in overnight to be observed.
Yeah.
Most of them are able to go home by the next day.
Yeah. And in terms of the long-term impact as well, so with gallstones, if they're not treated, if they're not managed correctly or in a timely manner, and symptomatic, I mean, what is the kind of complications that can happen after that? And is there something that you would always advise patients for?
So if somebody's got symptomatic gallstones, then you leave it. And often it does happen that people feel that they've had periods of pain-free episodes where the pain is gone, and they feel that, should I really need to have this operation? So they come to me for a discussion. But I do tell them that the risk of leaving gallstones behind is primarily having inflammation of the gallbladder in the future. Sometimes this gallbladder can get blocked and the bile inside can get infected and lead to a serious septic situation called empyema. Sometimes the stones can drop down the bile and cause jaundice. And again, as we know, sometimes stones can cause irritation of the pancreas and pancreatitis. So pancreatitis, most of the times patients need hospitalization and they get better. But sometimes it can turn into a serious situation.
Yeah. Turn very nasty. And we will go into all of the pancreatitis as well in the next hour. So please stay tuned for this as well. And just before we take a break, I just want to touch a little bit on cholecystitis. We mentioned it briefly in the previous segment, which is effectively itis of anything is just inflammation. And chole is the gallbladder effectively. So cholecystitis is the inflammation of the gallbladder. And if you could please just clarify to our listeners, what is cholecystitis other than just the inflammation of the gallbladder? And how would you say that's different to biliary colic?
So as a result of the gallbladder inflammation, the pain is similar to biliary colic, but pain is often worse on movement and on deep breathing. In a biliary colic, usually you won't get pain on movement or deep breathing, whereas in cholecystitis, because the gallbladder is irritating the undersurface of the diaphragm and therefore, as you try and deep breathe or move, you get pain. Sometimes the inflammation is so bad that it can press onto the bile duct and you might appear yellow or jaundiced, even though you've not passed a stone. And on examination, quite often you're very tender in the abdomen, as unlike a biliary colic, where you're not tender. So those are the main features of cholecystitis. So occasionally patients can come to hospital with very high temperatures, swinging pyrexia, as we say, and that is fluctuating temperatures, and that's probably a sign of infection brewing inside the bile, which is stuck in the gallbladder. So that needs urgent attention.
Absolutely. And in terms of the kind of risk of developing cholecystitis, are there certain groups of people that are more at risk of developing cholecystitis, or is it very similar to those who are also at risk of developing biliary colic?
I think the risks for biliary colic can be extrapolated to cholecystitis, but in patients who are critically ill in intensive care, those who are in the hospitals being treated for cancers, immunosuppressed or diabetic patients, these group of patients, and those who are receiving peripheral nutrition through an intravenous line, these are the patients who are actually at higher risk of cholecystitis. Particularly, we have to be very careful about diabetic patients.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we mentioned as well about kind of in terms of gallstone formation, that rapid weight loss can, you know, increase this the chances of gallstone formation. And as it's quite topical, I did want to touch on this as well. So there are medications obviously in the market like Ozempic or Mounjaro, which are kind of aiding weight loss. And sometimes if they're not used appropriately, they can lead to very rapid weight loss if they're not being regulated appropriately by the GP. Have you seen a connection between medications like Ozempic and Mounjaro and kind of gallbladder disease like cholecystitis or like biliary colic?
So the literature says that these medications, basically there's a, the pharmacological name is semaglutide. These can cause a lot of gastrointestinal side effects.
Mm.
And that can include colitis, inflammation of the colon, pancreas, mm. even the gallbladder. There isn't a clear explanation as to why this is happening, but I presume this is all to do with the medication interfering with metabolism
mm.
and gallbladder function. And there have been a few cases which have come to Milton Keynes Hospital with such presentations.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is, at the minute, a very largely grey area.
Yeah.
And needs to be investigated and looked into further.
Mm.
Obviously, it's easily available and people can pay and get these drugs.
Yeah.
But we still don't know the problems associated with these drugs.
Absolutely. I think what I always say is anything that you want to do, you want to go through the GP or, you know, a trusted source through the NHS or you know, if you're going privately, that's fine. But please don't just buy things over the internet, because that is something that we are seeing that is increasing. Patients that come to the hospital that have just bought something over the internet, who knows what you're getting if you're actually getting what you are paying for. So please, if you have any concerns about, you know, weight loss or weight loss management, we did do an episode about this, but if you have any concerns, then please seek some medical advice before buying anything on the internet. With regards to cholecystitis, we obviously mentioned that gallstone detection, the gold standard, is ultrasound scan.
Yep.
In terms of cholecystitis diagnosis, what would you say are the key blood test results and key diagnostic investigations that would confirm this diagnosis of cholecystitis?
So cholecystitis, to begin with, is a clinical diagnosis supported by blood tests mm-hmm. and imaging. So the patient has known to have gallstones, comes in with pain abdomen, typical of in the right upper abdomen, going to the back or shoulder, tender on examination
mm.
in the upper abdomen, then that's called Murphy's sign. And mm. that suggests that this patient's got cholecystitis.
Mm.
Then, of course, blood tests will show a raised white cell count. And another test, which is the CRP, C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory protein,
mm.
a protein that goes up in response to inflammation. So that
yes.
might jump up. And so if these are high, they suggest there's ongoing infection.
Mm.
And therefore, one would need to admit the patient usually
mm.
and treat them with antibiotics. And of course, confirm the diagnosis by further imaging.
Mm. Absolutely. And in terms of the management of acute cholecystitis, once it has been diagnosed, how is it managed? And is it always a surgical emergency where this person has to go into theatres and have their gallbladder removed?
So the gold standard is removal of the gallbladder. Mm. As per the NICE guidelines, you should, if anybody presents within 7 days of the initial attack, we should try and remove the gallbladder by an operation. After 7 days, the risk of complications, damage to the bile duct and bowel, etc., increases quite significantly. So it just depends on the time. But the gold standard is usually an operation.
Mm.
But of course, if there's a group of patients who are unfit,
mm.
or cannot have an operation, then we try and treat them with antibiotics,
mm-hmm.
manage their pain.
Mm.
But if these people don't respond to antibiotics, then sometimes we have to consider a special procedure where a tube is put into the gallbladder. It's called cholecystostomy.
Yeah.
It's quite often used in elderly, frail patients or patients who are not fit to have an operation. That helps tide over the symptoms, treat the infection, drain the infected bile, and the patients get better without having to expose themselves to the risk of an operation if they're not fit for it.
Mm-hmm.
But even with that, there's always a 10 to 20% chance that when they go home and once the tube is removed in a few weeks' time, that they may have a relapse.
Yeah.
But if you can't have an operation, then this is where
the best option
would be.
Absolutely. I think what I want to touch on now, actually, briefly, is the importance of making sure that an operation is safe, because quite often there might be instances where patients come in and, you know, the removal of a gallbladder seems, you know, relatively pretty straightforward, and patients might think, oh, this is a keyhole surgery, so it seems to be quite easy. And I think one thing that patients may forget is that it's not just the operation, but the risk of the anesthetic as well, which can all come together and make patients unsafe for an operation.
Absolutely, I agree with that. And therefore, the patient's overall medical background, any comorbidities, their exercise tolerance, everything needs to be taken into account, their functional ability. Because even though we could put the patient to sleep and do an operation, we have to make sure that we get the patient through the operation.
Absolutely.
And they wake up and respond well and you know, progress to getting better.
Absolutely.
So it has to be carefully discussed and thought through. And then once all the options are laid out, we choose the best option, which is in the best interest of the patient.
Yeah. I think it was, so we had Mr. Tenevici, who's another consultant surgeon at Milton Keynes Hospital. He came on a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking, and he was saying how having anesthesia or general anesthesia is a bit like running a marathon for your heart and lungs. You know, it does take a toll, and that's why we have to make sure that things are safe. Operations have to be done, you know, safely, and you will be kind of counseled with the risks and the benefits when we consent you for operations, should you be fit for an operation. So having touched on that, just to kind of continue with cholecystitis before we take our break, we mentioned how, you know, sometimes patients, if they are not fit for an operation and they have the tube put into their gallbladder to drain, it can sometimes recur. You can have recurrence of the cholecystitis. How often does this happen?
You mean the risk of recurrence?
Yes, the risk of recurrence.
If you've treated with antibiotics and or put a drain, even there's still a 20%, 25% chance of someone coming back with problems. Therefore, if the person is fit, I would think that the best option is an operation.
Absolutely. And are there any kind of proactive steps that individuals can take, also kind of primarily in the South Asian community, to reduce gallbladder inflammation or the chances of developing cholecystitis? Is it mainly, would you say, lifestyle related? Are there any other tips or pieces of advice that you would give to the community?
Lifestyle modifications will prevent a biliary colic, and therefore if the biliary colic doesn't happen, hopefully there'll be no stone impaction and no further progression to inflammation. But I think once inflammation sets in, then the patient, then the person would be probably best off coming to hospital and seeking urgent medical attention.
Absolutely. I think the reason that we always focus on prevention is that's the main kind of motive of this show, is to try and empower our patients to take their health in their own hands and realize that even, you know, small changes that they do to their day-to-day lives can make a huge difference in their long-term health and longevity as well. So we have in this hour discussed gallbladder-related issues. We've spoken about biliary colic. We've spoken about cholecystitis, so inflammation of the gallbladder, common signs, symptoms, the diagnosis, the management, some risk factors as well. So we've covered a lot of ground in the past hour. And we will take a quick break for some music, and then we will come back and talk about pancreatitis and a little bit about pancreatic cancer as well. So moving on to the next organ, which is the pancreas. So I hope you enjoy this next song, and we'll see you after this break.
आज की रात मजा हो उसका, आंखों से लीजिए। आज की रात मजा हो उसका, आंखों से लीजिए। वक्त बर्बाद ना बिन बात की बातों में कीजिए। वक्त रात मजा हो उसका, आंखों से लीजिए।
बाजारी जब हुस्न दिखाने जाएगी, होश उड़ाने वाली शोख नजर के जो पेच लड़ाने जाएगी। राय बरेली में तू बीच बाजारी जब हुस्न दिखाने जाएगी, होश उड़ाने वाली शोख नजर के जो पेच लड़ाने जाएगी। अरे बहन कितना जेवर कहना, तेज हवा से बच के रहना, गिर जाए तो फिर ना कहना झुमका गिरा ले।
What chumka? What chumka? What chumka? कसम से उतना फेक है तू पड़ गया, क्यों गले तुम छल की तरह चिपक के सेलो टेप जैसा लगा हुआ है, चेप जैसा ना किसी काम का निठल की तरह। बस ढूंढ रहा है मौका, खुल के मारेगा चौका, बाय चांस किसी लड़की का जहाँ झुमका गिरा ले।
काम काज करूं, तेरे हुस्न के ईगो का मसाज करूं, तेरा झुमका जो खोया गलती है तेरी, और थाने जाके एफआईआर में लॉज करूं। जानती है कि मैं तुझे पे चिढ़ता हूं, तू ये जानती है, तेरी आत्मा को मिलती ही शांति है। मुझे ऐसे काम पे लगा के बस ढूंढता रहूं मैं तेरा झुमका।
अरे बहन कितना जेवर कहना, तेज हवा से बच के रहना, गिर जाए तो फिर ना कहना झुमका गिरा रे।
झुमका गिरा रे बरेली के बाजार। एक गोली मेरे तेवर में है तहजीब की रंगीन रंगोली जैसे जैसे हो ईद में होली मेरे होठों से धुआं धार निकलती है जो बोली जैसे जैसे बंदूक की गोली मेरे तेवर में है तहजीब की रंगीन रंगोली जैसे जैसे हो ईद में होली मेरी जीवन की दशा बाकी सब फर्स्ट क्लास है बाकी सब फर्स्ट क्लास है बाकी सब फर्स्ट क्लास है Yeah.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that song break. There are a few songs, kind of a bit of an Arjit Singh special. I don't know if you guys know about the concert that's happening in September. I think it's the 5th of September. Arjit Singh is performing at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which luckily I have got tickets to. So actually both Mr. Taporia and I have got tickets to, which will be very exciting. So in this next segment of the show, we will talk about the pancreas, which is a very important organ. I think it's quite a underestimated organ sometimes. And we will break down again the kind of causes, the risk factors of pancreatitis, and talk a bit about the pancreatic cancer as well, but mainly focus on pancreatitis. So with Mr. Taporia being here as a HPV specialist, this is kind of right up his alley. In terms of the causes of pancreatitis, before we get into that, we'll talk about the organ itself. So how would you explain to patients, you know, what is the pancreas and what does it do? Because there are a lot of functions that it has.
So the pancreas is an organ which sits behind the stomach. And therefore, we always talk about stomach, bowel, gallbladder, but we don't talk too much about the pancreas.
Yeah.
But it's a very important organ. It produces a lot of enzymes which are responsible for digestion of fat, breakdown of protein and carbohydrates. And as you know, it produces insulin, which helps in metabolism of glucose, and also other hormones such as glucagon, somatostatin, etc., which all of them have a role in the body. So the pancreas is a very important organ.
Absolutely. And in terms of the pancreatitis, again, to kind of break this word down for our listeners, if you are just tuning in now, we were talking about cholecystitis or the itis, you know, what does that actually mean? And itis is just a term for inflammation.
Yep.
And pancreatitis is inflammation of the pancreas. So we can break down pancreatitis into acute pancreatitis and chronic pancreatitis. And when we use the words acute and chronic, we base that off of time scales. So acute pancreatitis would be kind of an imminent change with kind of can present with very, very severe symptoms, which we'll go into as well. And chronic pancreatitis being something that is a bit more kind of prolonged, long-standing. In terms of the causes of acute pancreatitis, how would you explain kind of how gallstones and even alcohol, for example, that can lead to the acute attacks of pancreatitis and other kind of common causes of it as well?
So basically, when patients have pancreatitis, there's inflammation and destruction of the cells in the pancreas called ACNR cells. Now, these cells, when they break down, they release a lot of enzymes, which lead to those enzymes eating into tissues and destroying tissues. Mm. So gallstones and alcohol are the most common causes of pancreatitis.
Mm.
Smoking also lines up as a common cause. So when you have excessive alcohol, it results in damage of pancreatic tissue and release of these enzymes, and that those enzymes then cause destruction of tissues around the pancreas, and can sometimes even lead to you being systemically unwell, dropping your blood pressure, affecting your lungs. The gallstones, when you pass a stone, as it passes through the bile duct and the pancreatic duct join together, and when the stone causes transient obstruction at that point, there's a lot of back pressure in the pancreatic duct. And again, this back pressure and obstruction leads to increased pressure within pancreatic tissue, and again the cells are susceptible to damage and release of enzymes, which cause further problems.
Absolutely. And I think it can be quite underestimated how severe acute pancreatitis can be. And I think our listeners might find it surprising that it can be fatal at times. And therefore, kind of urgent intervention and making sure that you are seeking appropriate medical help is very important for this. So we'll touch briefly on chronic pancreatitis before we move on to talk about the risk factors. And in terms of chronic pancreatitis, how would you kind of explain the difference between not just the time scale of between acute and chronic, but the differences in the kind of the etiology of acute and chronic pancreatitis?
So chronic pancreatitis is something which would be lasting which would probably persist for more than 6 weeks. And chronic pancreatitis is ongoing inflammation and tissue destruction and then scarring. So chronic pancreatitis leads to irreversible changes in the pancreas. In acute pancreatitis, you have inflammation and swelling of the pancreas, but then once that resolves, it comes back to normal. But in chronic pancreatitis, there is scarring and damage, irreversible damage, and then damage of different cells in the pancreas. Depending on how those cells are damaged, pancreatic function is affected. Patients then are at risk of long-term problems such as diabetes or malabsorption of fat. It leads to a condition called steatorrhea, where there is lots of fat in the stool, and the stools are very offensive, foul-smelling, difficult to flush away. That's because you're not absorbing the fat very well. So that's the main difference between acute and chronic. And then chronic can be associated with some hereditary conditions as well. Or it could be a continuum of acute, where the acute pancreatitis keeps relapsing or progresses to a chronic pancreatitis.
Absolutely. And in terms of the risk factors, one point that I did want to pick up on is, we spoke about alcohol, smoking, and gallstones as the most common risk factors for pancreatitis. Sometimes in South Asian populations, alcohol use may not be as kind of as publicized or as well spoken about. How would you say that this would impact the diagnosis or even risk awareness of pancreatitis?
So the problem with pancreatitis is it presents with upper abdominal pain, most often causing pain which goes to the left side of your abdomen, to the left flank, but it can be vague, it can be also in the right side of your abdomen. Now, if other causes, particularly with relevance to chronic pancreatitis, if other causes of pain have been eliminated, if you don't have any ulcers in your stomach or on an endoscopy, or you don't have gallstones on an ultrasound, but you still have upper abdominal pain, then there could be underlying pancreatitis. So I think people need to be aware that amongst the causes of abdominal pain, gastric ulcers, gallstones, and pancreatitis are the three common conditions which cause upper abdominal pain.
Absolutely. And in terms of kind of disclosing appropriate, information to your doctors, we're not here to judge you. So if you are, if you do consume more alcohol than you think you should, please do share this information, because it does help us make diagnoses as well and can help kind of point us down what's causing these symptoms too. In terms of the diagnosis of pancreatitis, how would you explain the pathway? So if a patient comes in and presents with kind of this upper abdominal pain and comes into the emergency department, they would be seen by the surgical team. How would you kind of explain the use of tests and imaging for the diagnosis of pancreatitis?
So the diagnosis of pancreatitis primarily relies on clinical assessment and a blood test. Clinical assessment, obviously, we'll get your history. We will know if there are any underlying risk factors, if you're known to have gallstones, if you're jaundiced, if you've been a smoker or you've been consuming heavy amounts of alcohol. The main blood test which we do is called serum amylase. And that is usually three times the normal value in patients with acute pancreatitis. In chronic pancreatitis, who have patients when they have flare-ups, sometimes the amylase levels may not be high because the pancreatic tissue has been destroyed and it's not producing enough amylase. And there's another enzyme called serum lipase, which is very specific for pancreatitis. And some hospitals employ that test for diagnosis. Usually for diagnosis of pancreatitis, we don't do any scans. But if you're not sure about the diagnosis, if there's a concern that this patient may have bowel obstruction or bowel perforation or other conditions, then we do a CT scan, which is basically in this situation where there's a diagnostic uncertainty.
Absolutely. And in terms of these, the management of acute pancreatitis, I think some patients might find it surprising that actually for cholecystitis, we say the gold standard is a surgery, but for pancreatitis, it's actually not. So how would you kind of explain that misconception to these patients in terms of how do we actually manage acute pancreatitis?
So yeah, that's very interesting. Unlike the gallbladder where you can take it out and get rid of it, you can't do that in the pancreas. It's a very crucial organ, and a lot of functions rely on the pancreas in the body. The treatment of pancreatitis is primarily supportive. We give fluids, nutrition, painkillers. The patient is admitted in hospital for observation. We do a serial tests of blood, of white cell count and other blood tests to see how the inflammation is progressing. Most of the times the condition is self-limiting and the patients get better once they feel better, able to eat and drink, and are going to the toilet, opening the bowels without any concern, then they can go, they are discharged.
Yeah.
But sometimes the pancreatitis can take a twist for the worse, and that's when the challenge comes in.
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, just to re-emphasize the fact that this can be a fatal condition.
Yes.
If it's, you know, sometimes we do our best medically, but because it is supportive management, we are also limited in what we can do at times. But we will do everything that we can to manage this this condition as well. Interestingly, when I had my elective, which was at the end of my fifth year at university, I was in California shadowing one of the surgeons there. And he was telling me, he said, "Gayathri, I'll give you three pieces of advice on how to be a good surgeon." He said, "Eat when you can, sleep when you can, and don't touch the pancreas." These are the three pieces of advice that he gave. And I think I've taken that with me. And I said, I definitely won't touch the pancreas, Dr. Bastidas. And in terms of the management of chronic pancreatitis, how would you say that that differs from acute?
So chronic pancreatitis is a very challenging condition. First of all, patients with chronic pancreatitis need long-term surveillance because they are at risk of pancreatic cancer. In the short term or in the immediate aftermath of chronic pancreatitis, patients can have diarrhea, loose stools, osteatoria because of poor fat absorption, malnutrition, and there are lots of fat-dependent vitamins which are not absorbed. And then patients can become diabetic. Now, sometimes in chronic pancreatitis, there are collections of fluid in the abdomen which can press on the stomach. Patients end up vomiting, not being able to eat well. So that needs to be dealt with by endoscopic techniques, by stenting, etc. And it's very important that if someone's smoking, that they should try and stop smoking, because smoking brings on chronic pancreatitis at a much, much younger age. And the outcome quite often is not very good with smoking-related chronic pancreatitis.
Absolutely. And in the kind of the rates of recurrence for acute pancreatitis, how would you kind of quantify this?
It's very difficult to give a numerical number to the rates of recurrence. But what is important is to take the right steps, preventive steps. And again, lifestyle changes. So you've got to be careful with your diet. You've got to avoid alcohol, smoking. Everything has to be in moderation. But sometimes, despite your best efforts and all preventive measures, there can be situations where pancreatitis can relapse. Pancreatitis is also known to be sometimes associated with stress. So you might think that I'm doing everything right, why am I getting pancreatitis? So it's more because of stress.
Absolutely. And in terms of the kind of the importance of surgery. So we've spoken about how, you know, in chronic pancreatitis, the use of endoscopic techniques, so camera-guided techniques to kind of insert stents, to open up the outlet of the stomach can be useful. Is there a role that surgery plays at any point during acute or chronic pancreatitis to help manage any complications, for example?
So in acute pancreatitis, the most common complication is pancreatic necrosis, which is can be life-threatening, and that's basically infection of the pancreas, of dead tissue in the pancreas. The mortality rate, the rate of someone, the rate of death could be as high as 40%. So this has to be actively managed. along with antibiotics, and sometimes one may have to go and do a procedure where we clean up the cavity full of dead infected tissue. This can be done endoscopically by going through the stomach and then puncturing into the pancreas and then cleaning it up and putting a stent. And in those centers where the facility doesn't exist, we may have to ask our radiologist to put a drain and to drain the tissue, the infected fluid. Usually in the first 4 to 6 weeks after pancreatitis, we tend to try and manage conservatively with as much support as possible, including intensive care. It's usually when these, unless it is a life-threatening situation, we wait for these fluid collections to organize. And then they're better dealt with once they're well organized with a proper mature wall.
And are there instances that patients will need to rely on external enzymes being provided? So long-term enzyme therapy that will need to be present for some patients.
So when patients have pancreatic insufficiency, they're not producing enough enzymes to digest fat particularly, then we have to give them supplements called Creon. And these help in digesting fat and reducing the incidence of loose stools or steatorrhea, as we say in medical terms. And these are used by titration depending on how rich the meal is when you're eating. If you're having breakfast with porridge, then maybe one Creon is enough. But if you're having lunch with fish and chips, you may need three Creons or four. So it just depends on the richness of the meal. And this is something individuals will have to work out on their own time.
Yeah.
Of course, we do a stool test for something called fecal elastase, and that gives us a measure of the amount of or the extent of pancreatic insufficiency, and then we deal with it accordingly.
Absolutely. And to discuss briefly the long-term impact of pancreatitis, is mainly, I guess, going on to chronic pancreatitis and the quality of life that is associated with this. What are the most common changes to quality of life that you've seen when patients are struggling with either recurrent pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis?
So such patients will have long-term pain, poor nutrition resulting in malnutrition, and sometimes poorly controlled diabetes. So these are the main problems which affect the quality of life. And then, of course, if someone goes on to develop cancer, then that's quite a difficult situation.
Oh, absolutely. And that, I think, segues quite nicely onto the pancreatic cancer segment. And, you know, we've kind of discussed the severity and the importance of not underestimating pancreatitis as well. And I think pancreatic cancer can be a little bit of a deceptive kind of cancer, where sometimes, you know, it may not be detected very immediately, or there might be kind of some other symptoms that can kind of indicate that this is slowly developing at times. And it can, again, it is quite an unfortunate kind of cancer as well, has a high mortality rate as well. So we'll discuss all of that in a bit more detail. But could you break down, you know, what is pancreatic cancer and how does it usually develop in patients?
So pancreatic cancer is a cancer which is the second most common cause of death in patients with gastrointestinal cancer. So cancers of the stomach, colon, pancreas. So pancreas is the second most common. And the 5-year survival with pancreatic cancer is very low. It's about 5%. And the peak incidence of this cancer happens around the 7th to 8th decade of your life. Patients who have, there are several risk factors, and we'll discuss them soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the causes or even risk factors, so with kind of understanding this, how would you break this down into kind of risk factors that are modifiable and risk factors that are kind of non-modifiable? So in terms of kind of risk factors that patients can do something about to try and mitigate, how would you break those down?
So it's important that some of the pancreatic cancers happen because of your occupational background. You're exposed to things like nickel, aluminium when you're working in the industry, or iodine, or some kind of other agents as well, which can result in production of toxic carcinogens, which can result in pancreatic cancer. Eating red meat is also supposedly associated with production of some chemicals called nitrosamines, and those can cause pancreatic damage and cancer. Then we've observed that patients who become diabetic are at risk of developing pancreatic cancer. So that's an important consideration. If somebody has pancreatic cancer, then the risk in the first degree relative is about 1.5 times.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, obesity is associated with the higher risk of pancreatitis. And then exposure to radiation. So these are some of the common things. So obviously lifestyle management, managing your weight, your day-to-day diet, getting rid of red meat as far as possible, I think should be minimized.
Yeah.
And remaining well hydrated, regular exercise, avoiding stress, stop smoking. Because smoking is very dangerous.
Yeah.
And of course, alcohol again in moderation. Now, these may sound as though these are common factors which we often give advice to everybody for the lifestyle, but they have an implication.
Absolutely.
When it comes to this. And of course, occupational hazards have to be dealt with in terms of minimizing your exposure.
Yeah.
All safety measures have to be taken in the workplace.
Absolutely.
And then most importantly, those who have chronic pancreatitis, they have an 8-fold risk of cancer. They have to be kept under long-term surveillance. And a very interesting group of people is those with hereditary pancreatitis.
Yeah.
They have a 40 to 70% risk of pancreatic cancer in their lifetime. So they have to be intensely kept under surveillance.
And monitored, I want to touch back on, you know, how you mentioned that sometimes it can feel as though we're giving lifestyle advice for absolutely everything that comes in through the door. But the importance of this is not just in terms of managing the condition, but also how we were saying that, you know, if you are generally fitter, healthier, have good what we call physiological reserve, which means how well your body can fight back in itself, all of these things will also benefit benefit you in the anesthetic assessment as well. So all of these things will make your operation easier, the recovery easier. All of these things come together to form a more holistic approach to managing these conditions. So in terms of the kind of the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, are there any kind of early symptoms of pancreatic cancer that people may miss or may overlook?
Well, that is the unfortunate part of this disease. So sometimes patients present with upper abdominal pain. They've had an endoscopy. It's normal, but they carry on having the pain. Sometimes patients have unexplained weight loss. Then, of course, patients may have late onset of diabetes in their life, or they may have poor nutrition, they're unable to absorb food properly, intolerance to fat. So these are all conditions which are not directly indicative of cancer, but suggest that something's going on.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think investigation with focusing on the pancreas is very important. Unfortunately, when patients present with pain and if they have pancreatic cancer, then sometimes the disease is locally advanced and beyond the stage where one could treat it by an operation.
Yeah.
So it's very important to seek early advice as soon as possible.
Yeah. And one of the things that always, you know, I think is hammered into us in medical school is very much if a patient presents to you with that are, you know, looking a bit yellow and their blood markers are showing that they are jaundiced as well and having jaundice, and if they have no pain, then painless jaundice can be quite a red flag sign that there might be some underlying, you know, pancreatic cancer. It doesn't have to be, but that is something that we were always told. How would you explain kind of the importance of that? You know, does that still hold, and would you say that's kind of an early sign that we can detect?
So of the lot of the patients who come with pancreatic cancer, only 13% present with painless jaundice.
Oh wow.
If they come with that, it is very good because it's an early sign. That suggests something blocking the bile duct, a mass in the pancreas or some lump around that area. And that can lead to urgent investigation and treatment. 46% of patients present with jaundice and pain.
Oh, I see.
Now, this is a situation where the disease may have progressed a bit, but may still be locally confined. And about 34% patients present with pain only. And that's where we end up missing on the diagnosis, because we think that this pain is because of some musculoskeletal reason or gastric reason. We carry on taking painkillers and other medications. We neglect, delay seeking attention. So, and again, as I said, onset of diabetes and weight loss should also be markers of something sinister going on.
Absolutely.
So one should seek urgent attention. About 7% people present with weight loss.
I think one of the key things for all, you know, the public to remember is unintentional weight loss is always a kind of red flag sign for us as doctors.
Absolutely.
We want to know this. And, you know, that doesn't mean you have to weigh yourself every day. You know, this is something that you will
notice.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll notice over time. And I mean, one question that I do want to ask, which is a slight tangent, I think, but why is it that pancreatic cancer is so deadly, I suppose?
Well, the trouble is that this disease, once it spreads, even for the disease which is locally confined, if you find it early and you operate, the risk of the survival is only about 15% over 5 years. It's a deadly disease because it can metastasize very soon, spread to other parts of the body, to your lung, to your liver, to your bones.
Mm.
And despite the best chemotherapy, with a lot of advances in chemotherapy, eventually this disease takes its toll.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's still a lot of research going on as to how to manipulate this disease genetically or by other drugs. In order to, because these drugs usually don't prolong survival, they kind of help improve your quality of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is some survival benefit for the new drugs, but it's not a lot.
Mm. And again, just kind of to mention as well that there will come a time that, you know, for all patients, if, you know, the what we are trying to do is not working, if the quality of life is being impaired, then there are certain decisions and conversations that need to be had, you know, whether or not managing this in a what we call palliative way, so managing symptoms rather than aiming for a cure is the better option, because it gives better quality of life. And this is something that we will discuss with you. Patients we will involve the palliative care team as well. So listeners can go back and you can listen to the episode on our website where I was in conversation with Dr. Jane Whale, who is the lead consultant for palliation at Milton Keynes Hospital. And she, you know, we kind of break down what palliative care actually is. And palliative care in pancreatic cancer can be very, very helpful, can play a very important role. So moving on to talking about the diagnostic aspect. So we spoke about, you know, the early symptoms that can be a kind of red flag signs, but also in terms of tests or markers, how are these used in the diagnostic process, as well as the role of imaging?
So there are some blood tests, tumor markers called, particularly called CA19-9, and elevated CA19-9 levels is a red flag that we should immediately jump onto. Doing a scan, possibly a CT scan of the abdomen with contrast and imaging the pancreas in particular. There are some scans which are pancreas protocol and will focus on looking at the pancreas properly. And I think CT scan remains one of the mainstays.
Mm.
Sometimes in patients with very early symptoms, just jaundice, painless jaundice, there might be a small lump less than 2 centimeters. A CT scan may not pick it up. And an MRI also may not pick it up. In those situations, we look at the scans, and if there's suspicion that there's some blockage or swelling of the bile duct, etc., then we ask for our gastroenterology colleagues to do a special endoscopic ultrasound. And the endoscopic ultrasound is very good for imaging the pancreas and looking at the lower end of the bile duct and taking a biopsy, etc., to help confirm a diagnosis.
Absolutely.
It'll pick up a lesion less than 2 centimeters.
Wow. Yeah. So again, ultrasound to the rescue.
Extremely sensitive, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the management, we have briefly touched on, you know, the use of surgery, chemotherapy as well, and even palliative care if required. And I want to just to kind of reiterate the importance of this. The survival rates of pancreatic cancer, how can they vary depending on the stage at the diagnosis?
So early stage where there's no metastasis, meaning no spread, that's 15% five-year survival. So you can imagine anything beyond that, if it's advanced, the survival is very poor.
Absolutely. I think it can be difficult to, like I said, because the pancreas is quite, I think, an underappreciated organ, and the importance of all of its functions, all of it comes together that, you know, once it starts to, you know, to have some element of dysfunction to it, the consequences are very severe, and because it is quite vascular as well, so it has good blood supply, helps the metastasis, so the spread of this cancer can be quite quick. So I guess the reason I wanted to discuss pancreatic cancer was because there is not that much awareness about it, and it should be something that is, you know, it's something that is very, that we use to, you know, this kind of platform to raise awareness for it.
Yeah. No, there has been advancement in chemotherapy. So mm-hmm. if the tumors are locally advanced, there are chemotherapy drugs which help to downsize mm-hmm. the tumor and to make it operable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, after the surgery as well, there are lots of modalities to treat. But obviously, it is a huge struggle to go through and has a huge impact on the patient's quality of life.
Oh, absolutely. And we've, you know, mentioned about the prognosis and that this is not great for patients with pancreatic cancer. Are there any factors that influence survival or influence kind of the kind of longevity of patients that have pancreatic cancer?
Well, eventually they'll end up having malnutrition.
Mm.
They will lose weight.
Mm.
So they get cachectic.
Mm.
And that is what impacts the survival.
Because
it's the malignancy which is eventually eating into the patient.
Yeah, yeah.
Causing them to waste away.
Mm-hmm. I think to kind of, you know, wrap this segment up, because it can be quite heavy to talk about cancers in general, but the importance is that, you know, please just, if you have any concerns at all, please seek medical help. You know, with any cancer, the key is to identify it early. That gives us time, and time quite often is not on our side, you know, with cancer. So we have to try and, you know, get as much time as we can. But that wraps up this segment of the pancreas. We are running well to time, which is good. And we'll wrap this show up now. And before I let Mr. Dupuyo go, I always ask all my guests to give three pieces of advice that they would like our listeners to keep in mind. This could be anything, you know, just lifestyle advice or more specific to gallbladder and pancreas. Any three pieces of advice that you always would want these community to keep in mind.
So lifestyle we've already spoken about many times, and everybody has probably understood by now.
Yeah.
Second thing is to seek early attention, medical attention for any symptoms, abdominal pain, weight loss, diabetes, particularly new onset.
Yes.
And the third thing is that please reach out to medical professionals and your GP, and there are many other support systems in the community. Your journey through treatment of such difficult medical conditions is quite horrendous, and you need support all the way.
Yes.
But there is plenty of support available, at least in the UK, for patients who are having a very hard time.
Absolutely.
After surgery or chemotherapy or anything of that sort.
Absolutely.
There's lots of counselling available. You have the opportunity to meet other patients who have had similar experiences, and you learn from the experience.
Yes.
So seek help.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are there to help.
Yeah.
You know, so we want to hear. Suffering in silence is not the way to go.
Yeah.
Making sure that you are, you know, speaking to the appropriate individuals, that is the key thing. So that wraps up today's segment, today's episode of Head to Toe, which thank you very much, Mr. Dupuyo, for coming on.
Thank you.
Our guests have definitely, you know, have been varied throughout this year, and we really enjoyed today's episode. So thank you very much. And I just want to remind all of the listeners once again that the aim of this radio show is to raise awareness of different health and well-being topics. It is not a replacement for an appointment with your doctor. If you have any concerns at all about your health and well-being, I encourage you to make an appointment with your doctor so they can give you appropriate personalized healthcare advice. So with that, this wraps up today's episode of Head to Toe. And I'm so sorry to say that, you know, next week is going to be the last episode of Healthy Zindagi. But I will see you next week on Sunday, and we'll have a bit of a time reminiscing over the past almost a year of Dr. Gayathri and Healthy Zindagi. And thank you so much for all of our listeners. You know, you've helped me grow, and I hope that, you know, you've enjoyed the content that I've been putting out. And but we will definitely see each other same time, same place. So this time next Sunday at 3 p.m. And until then, take care, and let's try and make our tomorrow better than our today.
नीम की नी बोरी